Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing likelihood that the Republicans may not be able to stage a vote to grandstand their opposition to Obama's deal with Iran, since 41 Democratic senators have pledged to sustain Obama's veto in spite of an expensive and determined lobbying effort by the so-called Israel lobby AIPAC. Jim Manley, a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs, who is a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, recently serving as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and before that as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy, joins us. We will discuss how the expected resistance to the Iran deal has petered out in the House and what procedural wrangling is going on in the Senate ahead of tomorrow's rally in Washington against the deal by presidential candidates Ted Cruz and Donald Trump, who might find themselves a day late, even if they are not a dollar short. Then we'll look into today's incident where Ted Cruz, along with Mike Huckabee, showed up in support of the county clerk in Kentucky who had defied the Supreme Court by not issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, only to find her Christian martyrdom was over and she had been released from jail. Matthew Avery Sutton, a distinguished professor of history at Washington State University and author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism, joins us to discuss the throngs of passionate theocratic supporters for the clerk, Kim Davis, who they see as a heroic Christian being persecuted for her beliefs, just like the Romans persecuted Jesus, before later feeding Christians to the lions. Then finally, we'll look into the latest upheaval at the Los Angeles Times, where the publisher and chief executive officer, Austin Buettner, was just fired by the paper's owners, the Tribune Company in Chicago. We will speak with Bill Boyarsky, a political correspondent for Truthdig and a lecturer in journalism at the University of Southern California, who retired as city editor of the Los Angeles Times in 2001, where he was a member of reporting teams that won three Pulitzer Prizes. The author of Inventing LA, The Chandlers and Their Times, we will discuss the demise of the newspaper since its sale by the Chandler family to a corporate pirate, Sam Zell. And joining us now is Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, where he served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Manley.
Thanks, Ian, for having me on again.
And Jim, do you think that the rally tomorrow that Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are holding, will it be a sort of kind of fall flat if a vote is taken in the Senate of effectively that will remove the need for the president to veto if the Republicans don't have the vote to proceed?
Well, I don't know if it's going to fall flat. After all, not only are Cruz and Donald Trump going to be there, but Congressman Steve King is going to be there as well. So I don't know if it's going to fall flat, but it's certainly going to be a sideshow and a circus. Having said that, to be perfectly clear, it has nothing to do with how this vote is going to play out in both the House and the Senate in the days to come. If only thing, it just highlights, you know, the intransigence of Republicans and how obstinate they are, their complete and utter unwillingness to try and sit down and negotiate an acceptable foreign policy.
So, but at this point, what's going on with the wrangling between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell? I mean, you've got 41 votes.
Well, let me stop you right there. It's actually 42. Senator Cantwell just announced an hour or so ago that she is for the deal, so it's now 42 Democrats.
But Senator Coons, who's one of the 42,
yep,
has said that he wants the vote to go ahead. I mean, the beauty of, if you will, if you believe in the Constitution and you don't want to have 535 secretaries of state, which would be the precedent that this, if this thing crashed and burned and blew up in the face of the president, not to mention that this deal is not just the United States, it's the entire Security Council at the United Nations that's behind this deal. And so if that blew up, it would be a huge blow for America's ability to conduct foreign policy in the future. So to my mind, there's a lot at stake. And I think it would be very helpful for the president and the country if this vote just simply didn't take place and that the president didn't have to veto.
I would obviously agree with that. But you asked me what's going to happen. And let me try and lay it out to the extent I can. You are correct about Senator Coons raising some concerns. Senator Manchin as well has also raised some concerns. I think all of this hopefully is going to be worked out at the weekly Senate Democratic Caucus tomorrow, where they're going to have a full and candid debate about how to proceed. There are majority of Democrats on the record more than willing to force filibuster this Iran resolution, but there's a handful that have some concerns. But the idea that Senate Republicans are complaining about how they're going to be required to put up 60 votes is beyond me. I mean, it's almost laughable. These guys are the this is a crowd that all but invented the filibuster on steroids, and now they're feigning shock and surprise that Democrats are demanding that they put up 60 votes. You know, methinks they doth protest too much. So what comes around goes around. So Senator McConnell today was on the floor arguing for a simple 50-vote majority. Senator Reid reminded him repeatedly that over the last couple years, Senator McConnell and his Republican caucus has insisted that all but the most routine piece of the legislation be subject to 60 votes. And, you know, that's where the discussion lies. There was no resolution tonight. As I said, Senate Democrats, at least, are going to talk about it in the caucus tomorrow and try and fashion agreement on how to proceed. But to be perfectly clear, and I think you know this, one way or another, you know, there is just no way that this resolution of disapproval, if you will, is ever going to be enacted in a law. If it gets out of the Senate and is subject to a veto, the president will veto and it'll die in the House. But as you mentioned, I mean, this is a very serious and very tricky situation. This is pulling the full faith and credit of the United States foreign policy at risk by subjecting this resolution to a veto, which is why the administration is anxious to try and avoid it and just have a straight up or down vote. Senator Reid has said that it's, you know, as well as anyone does, that this is going to be subject to 60 votes at the end. Let's just have the 60 votes after a couple hour, a couple of days worth of debate. But so far, at least, Senate Republicans haven't taken his offer.
And again, I'm speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie and Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, and he served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. But in terms of the House, it does feel like the whole thing has fizzled in the House, right?
Oh, sure. I mean, God bless Leader Pelosi. She very quickly moved to build up a firewall in the House. You know, she's got her troops in line, and if it ever got to that, like I said, they're well poised. But, you know, this thing has fizzled out, period. I mean, you know, going into August recess, you know, there was a lot of debate about whether this was going to be similar to, you know, 2009 with Obamacare, with all of these, you know, rowdy meetings with members back in their home states. None of that happened. The advertising by opponents of the deal were largely weak and ineffective. You know, the public polling, of course, is somewhat mixed. But, you know, throughout this process, there's been a vast majority of House and Senate Democrats that firmly believe that there is no viable alternative to this deal. It may not be the best deal, may not be the perfect deal, but there is simply no alternative to what the administration negotiated. And again, for Republicans to suggest that this is unconscionable, that foreign policy has never been conducted like this in such a partisan manner, I think is ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that House and Senate Republicans, from the very beginning of the process, made it very, very clear they would oppose anything that this administration came up with.
Well, you know, so far it seems to be a big blow for the lobbying efforts. There's, you know, AIPAC, yes, for example, spent a lot of money on it. The only people who've benefited from this have been the New York Times with these full-page ads. They've obviously had a windfall, but they don't seem to have gone anywhere, you know?
No, I agree. I mean, sure. So the Times made some money in advertising. There's some, you know, pollsters and whatnot that, you know, made some money, and some pundits that got, you know, some free airtime on TV. But again, a long time ago, at least a month or so ago, it was very clear that if this bill ever got out of the Senate, which it may or may not now, it was going to die a quick, painful death in the House once the House moved to the veto override. You know, it's been all over but the shouting, you know, for more than a month. But, you know, there are Republicans that want to score cheap political points by trying to keep on trying to, they think, put Democrats in a box, but Democrats aren't feeling that heat.
Well, it's interesting that the Democrats have outmaneuvered them, both Harry Reid in the Senate and Nancy Pelosi in the House. Now there are reports that Speaker Boehner may not, maybe ousted in a vote coming up in the fall.
It's that time of the year. There's a meeting of the so-called House Freedom Caucus going on at a nearby restaurant as we speak, where the coup plotters, the gang that couldn't shoot straight, if you will, is talking once again about whether they can challenge the speaker or not. The fact of the matter is, Ian, this is probably not going to be the last time you and I are going to talk in the next couple months, because it's going to be a long, painful fall. Republicans still haven't quite figured out the way to govern, and so we're looking at one deadline after another, starting with the vote that needs to occur, you know, on the Iran resolution by September 17th, and then we quickly get to the need to fund the government, a need to extend the highway bill, the need to extend the debt limit. And and there's reports tonight that Republicans are going to do what they do best, and that's kick the can down the road on funding the government, and they'll push a resolution to fund the government on a temporary basis till mid-December. So the Iran resolution is all but done, but there's plenty of other problems that will be facing Congress in the weeks and months to come that everyone's going to have to grapple with.
Well, the rally tomorrow that Senator Ted Cruz and Donald Trump are holding, along, you mentioned Congressman King as well, meant to rally support against the Iran deal. Interestingly enough, at today, and we're going to be talking about in a little in a few minutes, Jim Manley. Today, Ted Cruz showed up in Kentucky in support of the clerk, who was just they were going to sort of grandstand in front of the courthouse, but then the judge surprisingly let her, released her, and then Ted Cruz, as he went up to the throng of microphones to make a statement, was blocked by Huckabee's aides, and then Huckabee hogged the microphones.
I was wondering, I watched that spectacle on TV, I was wondering where Senator Cruz was, because he's like a magnet for the television cameras, and he was nowhere to be seen, so I just found out that that's, in fact, what happened. A couple different things. First of all, poor staff work on Senator Cruz's part. If I was working for Senator Kennedy or Senator Reid in such a situation, anyone ever tried to block me, I'd knock them off at the knees. But leaving that aside, what am I supposed to say? These guys are chasing, these Republican candidates are chasing precious exposure in the media. It's oxygen for them right now. The problem, however, and it's fine to laugh at it, but the problem is that more and more the Republican presidential primary campaign is seeping into the legislative process in both the House and the Senate. As I mentioned, you know, not only when it comes to the Iran resolution, again, ergo this sideshow, this freak show, if you will, that includes Donald Trump tomorrow, but then also a demand by House and Senate Republicans to to shut down the government if Planned Parenthood isn't defunded. And then again, as I mentioned earlier, the big kahuna is in December when they have to debate the debt limit. And all of these Republicans are going to have to fight as hard as they can to try and get to the right or their colleagues so they can appeal to, you know, their so-called base. It's going to be very, very – I don't envy Senator McConnell and Senator Speaker and Speaker Boehner in this particular aspect of it. They're going to have to deal with a lot of characters. They're going to try to make a name for them at the expense of their respective caucuses.
Well, tomorrow's spectacle with Cruz and Trump might well be the blind leading the blind in terms of foreign policy. I mean, you know, Trump just had a big rally in New York where he introduced a chief aide to this general in Indonesia who lost the recent elections, and mercifully so, because this general has a human rights record of having murdered millions of people,
literally
millions of people. And he lauds this guy as though, you know, he's one of my buddies, you know, and we're going to do great foreign policy. You lug out. You can't, you know.
Well, wait a minute. Are you talking about the same Donald Trump who said a couple of weeks ago that he took his cues on foreign policy from watching the Sunday shows? Sideshow Circus. You know, other unprintable names on the air. It's getting ridiculous. And as much as I'd like to laugh at it, I mean, these kinds of stunts, you know, damage the reputation of the United States around the world. Like it or not, President Obama is our commander in chief. He's the president of the United States, and as such, he has the authority to negotiate these kinds of agreements with governments. In this particular instance, I think he and Secretary Kerry did the best job they could, recognizing that, Iran's a very, very bad government. You're going to have to watch very carefully. But again, this is what diplomacy and foreign policy is all about.
Right, but the debate has been absurd because it's not an apples versus orange debate. It's an apples versus nothing debate. There's absolutely no alternative to this deal except this wishful thinking that maybe you could make a better deal. I mean, it's completely nutty. You know,
it is. The idea that were this deal to fall apart and, you know, our allies around the country would around the world would step forward again and negotiate another agreement is absolutely ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that there's, you know, plenty of foreign governments have been eyeing the chance to get into Iran. Now that the door's open, they're going to seize it. There are ways to enact further sanctions if there is cause to do so. But the idea that you can restart this whole process is absolutely ridiculous. And again, it's just driven by a myopic, you know, animus towards this president. If President Obama is for it, you know, they can't be against it. They can't be for it as well.
Well, Jim Manley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jim Manley, who's a senior director at Quinn Gillespie & Associates Public Affairs in Washington, D.C. He's a 21-year veteran of the U.S. Senate, where he served as senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid for the past 6 years, and before that served 12 years as an aide to the late Senator Ted Kennedy. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about how Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee showed up in support of the county clerk in Kentucky, only to find that she had just been released from jail. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Avery Sutton, who is the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Sutton.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be back on.
And Matthew, today GOP presidential contenders Mike Huckabee and Ted Cruz showed up in support of the Rowan County clerk, Kim Davis, who I think the federal judge, Judge Bunning, I think preempted them somewhat by releasing her. But nevertheless, rallies were held and these presidential candidates were able to grandstand. And there's been an enormous number of people that have shown up across the country, not so much local people, but people from surrounding states who have shown up in support of Kim Davis, who has been in jail for a couple of days, was holding up signs, "Free Kim Davis." But what I see in the coverage, apart from some rather ugly outbursts from some of them talking, screaming about sodomites, etc., most of the supporters of Kim Davis express a sense of martyrdom, that somehow she's a Christian martyr. How much is that in the sort of DNA of American evangelicals?
Well, I think, Ian, you're exactly right. There's a strong sense that she's a martyr, that she's sacrificing herself for a greater cause. And, of course, for these evangelicals, they can tie their actions back to Jesus and to the ultimate martyrdom of Christ giving himself to death on the cross. Nevertheless, though, I think there's this growing sense of persecution among American evangelicals, that it's somewhat ironic that they've had so much power and had so much success in the last few decades. And yet, nevertheless, they still seem to sense that things are turning against them and that the government is essentially out to get them, out to take away their freedom and their liberty.
And is there any way that, you know, empirical evidence and a rational discourse can be held here? Because I don't think there's any dispute, surely, that America is the most religious-friendly country on the planet.
Yeah, no, I think you're right, and that's absolutely the case. But one thing that's happened in American history is groups have often claimed to be outsiders. They've often claimed to be marginalized. It's an extremely American thing to do. And the irony is exactly what you say, that, in fact, in the U.S., there is a substantial amount of religious freedom. But nevertheless, anytime something comes up in which a religious group, especially a powerful religious group that has powerful politician friends, whenever they can claim that they're being oppressed or their rights are being violated, this resonates. This is much better than being against something. They're not, you know, you can only go so far being against gay marriage or being against abortion. But when you can flip the rhetoric and make it about religious liberty or about religious freedom, who's going to argue with your inalienable rights to freedom and liberty? That seems to be ensconced in the First Amendment. And so it's a much more powerful, much more persuasive argument, and one that's going to resonate a lot more deeply.
Well, if you're going to be carrying signs that say Supreme Court equals the new ISIS of America, I don't know that you're going to win over too many people in the middle here, if you will, in terms of a cause. I mean, there is quite a bit of hyperbole, shall we say.
No, and that's absolutely true. And there's no doubt there's going to be, you know, a bunch of nutcases involved who are going to take this to a crazy extreme. But I think the larger issue, and this is really a continuation of the protests over Obamacare in the sense that the government was mandating that private religious businesses pay for contraceptives that they didn't believe in. And that's when these evangelicals, as well as conservative Catholics and others, began to really claim that their religious rights were being violated. And so we're seeing here now an extension of that, or a ramping up of that.
And the judge, though, in letting her out, apparently, I mean, the fact of the matter is, I think even though Mike Huckabee made this speech praising Davis, saying that she had more courage than any politician I know, and if somebody needs to go to jail, I'm willing to go in her place. Now that she's free, one wonders about the point of that promise. But my understanding is that the judge is basically saying that he's released Davis because five of her six deputies have begun issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. And the only holdout, of course, is Davis's own son. And that as long as she doesn't interfere with the continuing work of the five of the six who are issuing licenses, then, you know, it sort of becomes moot. Do you think that Cruz and Huckabee are a little late here for the rally, or will they just continue this kind of agitating, even though, in effect, the problem's been solved?
Yeah, no, I don't think they're late. I think they will keep agitating, and the problem has been solved in the short term in this particular case, or at least we think it may have been solved. But the larger issue, which Cruz and Huckabee have been tapping into for a while, and again, this goes back to Obamacare and other issues, is this question of religious freedom and religious liberty, and in this sense among evangelicals that they're a persecuted minority, and that as more and more other groups are getting rights and freedoms and liberties, theirs are being taken away. So they see this as a zero sum. The more rights other groups get, gays and lesbians or others, then the fewer rights they have. And the interesting thing about the tactics here is evangelicals have been very savvy in the last 10 or 15 years, really probably 20 years, at studying the civil rights movement, the battle for African-American civil rights in the 1960s. And they've taken essentially a page right out of Martin Luther King's playbook in terms of this idea of being willing to practice civil disobedience, being willing to go to jail. For Huckabee to say he would go to jail, and that's exactly what Martin Luther King Jr. did. He said he would go to jail rather than see his surrogates go to jail. And so it's a smart posturing, it's a smart positioning, and I don't think it's one that's going to go away. It's giving us a taste of what's to come rather than a one-time thing that's going to come to an end.
Well, of course, Southern evangelicals did not support Martin Luther King, but I guess that's not the issue, right?
No, exactly. That they were on the wrong side of that issue, and I think many of them now know that. But so that's, they're positioning themselves now in doing what was successful. And the civil rights movement was a tremendous success in terms of policy. And so now they want to take the tactics that the civil rights movement used and hope to use it for their own agenda.
So in terms of religious liberty, the issue of religious liberty, in this case, the Supreme Court settled the gay marriage issue, and that's why this county clerk was jailed, because she refused to obey the Supreme Court and basically said she's acting on God's authority. And now that the judge has sort of pulled her over and given her a some kind of civics lesson here, where do we stand, though, in terms of this other strand that's still out there in the legal world in terms of a possible something to be built upon by those that feel that they've lost, well, they haven't indeed lost the battle in terms of gay marriage, which they really obviously upsets them. And that is, of course, this idea of expanding on religious liberty, expanding on the Hobby Lobby case. We saw what happened in Indiana, where the governor started to grandstand on that, and that blew up in his face. But that's not to say that this battle's not over. Do you think there's some room to maneuver there for the evangelicals?
I don't think in terms of long-term success there's room to maneuver. There's certainly room to maneuver to get voters out at the grassroots, to get them into the election cycle, into the election process, and to support candidates who make issues out of religious liberty. But in terms of, you know, larger legal precedent, I think they're on the wrong side of history. I think they're going to lose. You know, the classic example that I teach my students in my history classes when we talk about these issues is the case of, you know, interracial marriage, that many, many religious groups refused to marry or to license people who, you know, wanted to marry somebody of a different race. And they had sincere, devout religious convictions about this. But ultimately, the Supreme Court said, no, that's not going to stand. And today, of course, it's a non-issue. There's very few, if any, religious groups, and certainly no major religious groups in the U.S. that would stand opposed to interracial marriage as an issue of religious liberty. And I think the gay marriage thing is going to be the same. I think 20, 30, 40 years from now, students are going to look back at what's happening today and think this is just insane, this is just ridiculous. But in the short term, it's going to work for Huckabee, it's going to work for Cruz, it's going to work for the Republican parties, because if they can convince these evangelicals that they're martyrs, that they're outsiders, that, you know, their rights are being violated, then that's going to add more power, more strength, and more motivation to get them out to the polls to vote Republican.
So in terms of the passions here, and this sort of deep sense of martyrdom, and I mean, a lot of these people are expressing very, very basic theocratic ideas. And Ted Cruz's father is a theocrat. He's a dominionist. He's a preacher who believes that God or Jesus should be the head of state. Is there any understanding in that world of the irony, the deep irony, that here in the United States for the last, decade and a half has been at war with militant theocratic regimes in the Middle East and non-state actors like the Islamic State or ISIS or Daesh? I mean, and you can go back further to the Taliban. You know, I mean, it strikes me as an extraordinary irony that George W. Bush, for example, prosecuted the war on terror against theocrats abroad when he was in bed with theocrats at home.
Sure. Yeah, and they, of course, wouldn't see it that way. They would see this as sort of an absolute battle between good and evil, and they're on the side of good. And so for them to say, you know, one political system is theocratic and another is also theocratic, it's a non-starter. They're gonna look at their system and say, we want to make it as godly as we can based on their interpretation of the Bible and their interpretation of Christianity. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, of course, religious people, they're religious because they believe in they want their ideas or their values, which they think are going to best serve humankind. They want them as implemented as widely as possible. And so for these folks, they're not going to see an irony. They're just going to see a goal, and the goal is to have the most Christian nation they can, believing that the more Christian the nation is, then the better the influence it will be on the rest of the world. And ultimately, when Jesus comes back again and judges individuals and judges nations, that's their hope, is that he will look at the United States and judge the United States favorably because of what it did for Christianity.
So do you think in any way, Matthew Sutton, that the secular forces in this country have, in fact, perhaps some of it's backfired? You know, a lot of the evangelicals feel passionately against the ban on prayer in school, and they chafe at the idea of this separation of powers argument that has disallowed the prayer in school. And my sense is that, you know, rather than sort of make martyrs out of these people, wouldn't it make more sense not to appear hostile to religion, but to basically encourage comparative religion, the teaching of comparative religion in school? That way, you would have generations of kids that would grow up with a much broader perspective on religions and a much broader menu. Because the problem that I have with evangelicals and also Muslim, Christian, Hindu, Jewish fundamentalists is that they believe that they've cornered the market on the Word of God.
Right, yeah. No, I definitely think that would be one solution, although I think the public schools, at least in my state in Washington and in California where I used to live, they actually do a relatively good job of teaching religious knowledge, of teaching about different religions, both in the context of holidays as well as in history curriculum. And, you know, there's a larger issue right now, of course, of schools cutting humanities curriculum in general and focusing more on science and more on math. And so, you know, you're not going to get religion in if all you're doing is adding and subtracting. But nevertheless, I think schools have adapted to exactly what you've said and are trying to educate their students to understand the diversity of views, the plurality of ideas about religion. But nevertheless, I'm not sure that secularists are to blame for putting evangelicals in this position. When the Supreme Court first came out against mandated school prayer, a lot of evangelicals were actually in favor of it because the prayers that were being practiced at that time were so generic and so nonspecific and so general that they really were essentially meaningless to any true evangelical believer. It was only when the issue became politicized and then came politicized in the 1970s in the context of abortion and some of the other issues that allowed evangelicals to think they were being persecuted. Some of these had to do with tax-exempt status of universities like Bob Jones University. All these things worked together to convince evangelicals that, wait a minute, God is being taken out of the public schools in new things. Sex education and other things are moving into the schools. And so there was a shift, but again, I don't know that the secularists are to blame. I think it's more a matter of savvy Republican politicians who sensed an opportunity and seized it. And the long-term effect has really been damaging to evangelicals in terms of their churches, I think. There's a lot of disillusionment among young evangelicals because of this politicalization. But nevertheless, it's continuing to work, as Huckabee and Cruz demonstrate.
So how is the evangelical bloc doing in this election, particularly in the Republican primary process, where they've long dominated the process? And they've sort of had pretty much a litmus test that everybody has to follow. I find it quite extraordinary that the leading candidate on the Republican side is Donald Trump, who's a sort of, what, a libertine from New York who owns gambling casinos. I don't know how many times he's been married. He's hardly a paragon of Christian values. But there he is right at the top. You know, and then of course, back in 1979, 1980, in the campaign, Ronald Reagan, as a divorced Hollywood actor, won over the evangelicals over a genuine preacher from the South who was a Sunday school teacher, Jimmy Carter.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, this is what I love about history and why I love teaching religious history, because there are so many of these great, rich ironies. But in terms of Trump, the polling data I've seen demonstrates that a lot of evangelicals at the grassroots level really like Trump. And I think a number of people have come out and explained how ridiculous this is in terms of what evangelicals have claimed to stand for in the last, you know, two decades. However, among evangelical leaders, the ones who have been polled, there's very little support for Trump. I mean, I think those who have really thought through the issues and who are speaking publicly and taking a position that they have to defend, that they have to justify, they realize that Trump is just bad news for the party, or at least bad news for their role in the party. And so, I'm fascinated by Trump. I'm curious to see how long this phenomenon lasts. But I don't think he's getting a lot of support from the evangelical power players.
But do they have the clout that they used to have? If he's doing that well and they're against him, and apparently their objections are not having any effect, would that indicate that they've lost their clout, or their clout's diminishing?
I think so, and I think it goes in cycles. You know, with Jerry Falwell dead, Pat Robertson not having much of an influence, James Dobson retired, Phyllis Schlafly mostly retired, the leaders of the old religious right are in fact gone. And so now we're waiting to see who's going to emerge and who's going to take the reins. When Jerry Falwell retired from the moral majority in 1987, everybody thought the religious right was dead. Then Ralph Reed swooped in with the Christian Coalition and really had substantial success in the 1990s. And so we could be at a moment where the religious right truly is finally dead. But I'm more expect that we're going to see a new generation of leaders, some people who are able to tap into current issues, but are able to do it in a more sophisticated, more savvy way. They're going to take the reins, and they're going to redirect the energy of evangelicals. But where that's going to go and how it's going to happen remains to be seen. And at this point, I think it is a group that is dying for leadership. There's no clear leaders at the moment.
Well, but just in closing, the most successful evangelist today, as far as I know, is this fellow Osteen, who has this huge megachurch. And his mantra is, God doesn't want you to be a whiner, God wants you to be a winner. And he practices what's called the prosperity gospel. And if there was ever a candidate for the prosperity gospel, it's Donald Trump.
Yeah, in some ways. And, you know, Osteen is very evasive when it comes to political issues. He's smart enough to know that that's turned off a lot of people in recent years. Nevertheless, Trump may well fit with Osteen's philosophy in a lot of different ways. Although on some of the moral issues, of course, as you pointed out, Trump would violate it. But where this all shakes out as the Republican field narrows will be very interesting.
Well, thank you very much for joining us here today, Matthew Avery Sutton.
Thanks, Ian. As always, it's been fun.
It has indeed, and thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Avery Sutton, who's the Edward R. Meyer Distinguished Professor of History at Washington State University and the author of American Apocalypse, A History of Modern Evangelicalism. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the latest upheaval at the Los Angeles Times.
Bruce Rodner!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man. Sit down, man.
Netanyahu.
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin.
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich.
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith.
Sit down, man.
It's the money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Bill Boyarsky, a political correspondent for Truth Dig and a lecturer in journalism at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. Boyarsky was city editor of the Los Angeles Times when he retired in 2001 and was a member of reporting teams that won three Pulitzer Prizes. A columnist for the Jewish Journal, Bill Boyarsky blogs for LA Observed and is the author of Los Angeles, City of Dreams, Backroom Politics, co-authored with his wife Nancy, and his latest book is Inventing LA, The Chandlers and Their Times. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Boyarsky.
Good good to be talking to you.
And, of course, your book, The Inventing L.A., The Chandlers and Their Times, we can only wish for a family oligarchy to return, right? Like the Schultz.
Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with a with an oligarchy, especially that one, which in its later decades became a much more of a constructive force in the community.
Well, but that's probably a good point to start our conversation, given the latest upheaval at the Times, where on Tuesday it was announced that Austin Buettner, the publisher and chief executive of the Los Angeles Times, was dismissed by the Tribune Company in Chicago, who owned the paper, and apparently he's being replaced by Timothy Ryan, chief executive of the Baltimore Sun. But we'll get to that, obviously. But surely when the Chandlers sold the paper, wasn't there a battle between the family, in effect, and that the kind of Orange County branch of the family wanted the money and the more enlightened branch of the family wanted the tradition of the paper to continue, which, of course, ever since it was sold, it's been systematically eviscerated?
Right, right. The conservative Chandlers or the right-wing Chandlers were never happy with the way the paper was run by Otis Chandler, the last son of the Chandlers, and by his mother and father. They felt that it was far too liberal, and they weren't getting enough money out of it. And if we could credit them with being far-seeing, they might have seen also that the print newspaper business was going downhill fast.
So they made this terrible deal, did they not? I mean, was that...
Well, I think it wasn't terrible for them financially.
No, of course it wasn't, but...
It was good for them financially, but they sold the paper to the Tribune, thinking that it was an enlightened company. They made the deal because it was very good for them financially, and they sold it to a company that was smaller than Times Mirror, and which had a smaller viewpoint, which was sort of a slow moving, not going anywhere company, and they sold it, and from then on it went downhill. Now, you've got to put this in context with the decline of print, which started as this was all happening about this time, was that people's reading habits changed drastically, and their shopping habits and their advertising habits. And so, you know, you might say no matter what anybody did, this was a business going downhill fast.
Yeah, but surely the fact that this corporate raider, Sam Zell, bought the paper and paid off the Chandlers, particularly the Orange County branch, the conservatives, ones who wanted to cash out, the price that the paper paid for him, because he was a kind of a heartless sort of robber baron.
He was a pirate in the worst sense of the word.
Right.
Not a jolly pirate.
So describe...
Not a Walt Disney pirate, but
sure.
A real pirate.
So describe what he did, because my understanding is he leveraged the pension plan of many of the employees in order to put the deal together to buy it, and then he turned around and fired them all.
Well, what he did was he borrowed heavily using the pension, one of the pension plans of the employees, one of the pension plans. There were two or three around, and he borrowed heavily. To buy the papers, to buy the Times Mirror Company and the Tribune Company, Well, he borrowed and borrowed, and the business kept going down and down and down. And the man, you know, had no journalistic vision or sense of obligation to journalism. Squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. And soon was squeezing the life out of these papers, including the L.A. Times.
And again, I'm speaking with Bill Boyoski, who's a political correspondent for Truthdig and a lecturer in journalism at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication. Boyarsky was city editor of the Los Angeles Times when he retired in 2001 and was a member of reporting teams that won 3 Pulitzer Prizes at the LA Times. A columnist for the Jewish Journal, Bill Boyarsky blogs at LA Observed and is the author of Los Angeles, City of Dreams, Backroom Politics, co-authored with his wife Nancy, and his latest book, Inventing LA, The Chandlers and Their Times. So let's go to today's news with the firing of Austin Buettner by the Tribune Company or the board. And of course, this is not the first. This is the latest of a series. A very popular editor at the Times, John Carroll, who was responsible for, at least in his tenure, there were an enormous amount of Pulitzer Prizes won by the paper. He apparently fought the Tribune Company over staff cuts. He resigned.
Dean Baquet, his successor, Dean
right.
Baquet.
Right.
That happened to him. The publisher at the time was forced out. The editor who succeeded Baquet was forced out. I mean, it is like a dysfunctional sports franchise. The way it's been run. And meanwhile, while all this is happening, the staff has been reduced down to 500 journalists and. The circulation has dropped by half.
And what was it when you were last there, Bill?
It was well over 1 million, and the staff was about 1,000, 1,200, 1,100.
So what's your understanding then? You described the Chicago Tribune in Chicago, the board, the people that own the paper and make these decisions, as a dysfunctional sports franchise. The only problem is, the franchise is not the Chicago Bears. It's what?
Well, the franchise. The trouble is that the franchise is responsible. I mean, the newspaper has an obligation to report on its community and its state and its nation in a fairly uncompromising way. I'm not saying that these newspapers. Have been or are great around the country. You know, this is not some shining sort of city on the hill. But they have, over the years, put reporters in the state capitals, in the city halls, on the streets, all over the place, reporting what is happening in their city. Now, in this particular since we're talking about Los Angeles, this is a terrible loss there. I think there are two, maybe three reporters covering City Hall when there used to be 7 or 8. There's one reporter covering the county. A couple cover transportation. The reporters have been reduced. The number of reporters have been reduced in style, in size. And so there goes the watchdog function of the newspaper. Now, I know people will say, well, your paper's never really exercised that watchdog function. Well, I think it has. Great or not so great, it's there. It's been there reporting on what's happening. That is all gone. And all gone while all these tremendous things are happening in Los Angeles that need absolute constant daily watching. For example, the relationship between the police and the African-American community. I mean, that is not something you can go in and cover with a story every 3 weeks or something. It needs daily, daily coverage with 1 or 2 reporters on it all of the time. In the community, in the police department, in City Hall, an unwavering focus on that, which happens to be the most important story that's occurring here in Los Angeles right now. Another story that people think is important are the traffic. A huge traffic plan is has been approved by the city council and the mayor, which will reduce the space available for cars and increase that available for bikes. Well, okay, and that might be good or not, but it needs incredible daily banging away kind of coverage. So So that's what they're not giving. And they're not giving it not because the reporters aren't smart and talented, because they are, and I know them. I'm really impressed with them. It's that there's not enough of them, and they work under constant fear of getting laid off. And their editors work under constant fear of being laid off or second-guessed. I can only imagine what it's like at the paper today.
But again, the central dysfunction that you've pointed out, Bill Boyarsky, is that you've got this dysfunctional franchise in Chicago making these what appear to be arbitrary and somewhat capricious decisions about what's happening in Los Angeles, and all of the institutional talent that's built up, they keep eviscerating in this serial way. I mean, what's their motive? What are they?
Their motive is the bottom line. They've always felt that the Times was an overstuffed, pampered institution, and more money could be squeezed out of it. If you don't mind me quoting myself here, this is what I posted on LA Observed just now. The corporate overseers in Chicago have always seen the Los Angeles Times as an odd, undisciplined place that had to be whipped into line. So here they come again, clueless invaders. And all we readers can do is jeer their arrival and offer the greatest sympathy to the remaining journalists working for them, still dedicated to their tasks. And what is their task? Pat Morrison, you know what was really odd about this whole thing? It shows the Chicago mentality. Austin Buettner was the publisher and CEO, and a lot of people at the paper didn't like him. I mean, he's not a warm and cuddly guy, I guess. I only know him slightly. I talked to him once when he was considering running for mayor, and I thought he was very smart, but he didn't have the gift of or the curse of bull needed, you know, to be a politician. And I know that people at the Times, you know, are shell-shocked waiting for more layoffs. So that's what I know about the guy. But I was very impressed with what Pat Morrison wrote on his Facebook page. Oh, by the way, the first thing they did with Austin was cut off his email.
Right,
so access to the Times email.
Sure,
is that amazing?
Well, he had to publish. He had to go to his Facebook page to let people know what happened.
He had to go to his Facebook page to let people know what happened. And Pat Morrison wrote in her comment to his post on his Facebook page, "Thank you, Austin, for understanding and caring about Los Angeles as an extraordinary world city, and its flagship paper as having an important civic role." The reason the Founding Fathers singled out the press in the Bill of Rights is because of the vital public part it must pay in order for democracy to function. And I think that's what all of us who were, especially those of us who wrote about public affairs, believed. And I certainly did, and all my colleagues did as we went about their jobs, as our jobs. And I think that today's reporters do also.
Well, I can certainly identify with what's happening at the Times, because here at KPFK and Pacifica, under new management, all of the popular programmers that bring in the revenues and have the listenership that serve the public, they're trying to get rid of us and replace us with non-union so-called activists from the oppressed communities who have no community support, but basically it's sort of union busting going on at the People's Radio Station. So it's quite surreal.
Well, it is tragic, and I know how you feel, how all of you feel working under that oppressive atmosphere. It's hard to be creative, I think.
Yeah, it's hard to show up, but of course they don't want us to show up.
Right.
They want us to give up our programs to their friends. So, but back to the LA Times, what's your sense then of whether there was some pique on the part of the Tribune people, the fact that Austin Buettner was talking with the billionaire Elo Broad, who wants to buy the paper. Also, I think Geffen, another billionaire in L.A., wants to buy the paper. What's their problem? If they're only interested in money, why not pay them off if they don't want to be responsible stewards for this newspaper?
Apparently, they'd get hit hard with taxes.
I see.
And it's a tax deal. And, you know, it might just be to their interest to let the thing just collapse and go into bankruptcy. And if it goes into bankruptcy, maybe at that time the Broads of Los Angeles and Buettner, if he's still interested, could take the thing over. I don't know. I think that's a sort of a long-shot hope. But that's... They're going to squeeze this thing. They're going to squeeze every dollar they can out of this paper and squeeze the staff and reduce it as much as they can until there's absolutely, until there's hardly anything left. And that will be their gift to Los Angeles. It'll be a paper that can no longer cover civic affairs, can no longer cover sports, can no longer cover culture. All of the activities that, you know, in this huge, complex, interesting city will go away, all not be reported. And the idea that blogs can take up the slack is dead wrong. I mean, I write for one of the most popular blogs and one of the best blogs in this area, L.A. Observed. And in no way, as good as Kevin Roderick is in putting it out, can it substitute for the Los Angeles Times. And I write for a really a distinguished, great website, Truthdig, and everybody works really hard there. But, I mean, we know that we break stuff, but we're not a substitute for what was once considered the mainstream press. We're there, and we're a strong progressive voice, and a good voice. But we can't provide the full range of coverage that's required of a city and a country this complex.
Well, Bill Biaski, it is mystifying. It's almost like there's just a group of corporate zombies in Chicago signing death warrants.
Right.
And there's a brain-dead quality to it, don't you think?
Well, that's what I think. There is a brain-dead quality to it. And, what do they want? To make it into a zombie newspaper?
Well, Bill, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay. Good luck to you. Thank you for calling me.
And again, I've been speaking with Bill Biaski, who is a political correspondent for Truthdig and a lecturer in journalism at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. Biaski was city editor of the Los Angeles Times when he retired in 2001 and was a member of reporting teams at the Times that won 3 Pulitzer Prizes. A columnist for the Jewish Journal, Bill Biaski blogs for LA Observed and is the author of Los Angeles, City of Dreams, Backroom Politics, co-authored with his wife Nancy, and his latest book is Inventing L.A., The Chandlers and Their Times. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.